here on ESPN Plus alongside Hercules Gomez. I'm Sebi Salazar on what is episode 220, Herc, of this show. On 220, what are you wearing?
This is something that I found in the closet. I was doing a little bit of cleaning, trying to get some. I was trying to find some memorabilia, and I found this gem. This is back in the day, as you can see, 2005. You might remember that year.
Yes, who won MLS Cup that year?
The Galaxy.
There you go. And who was the team MVP?
You're looking at
there
him.
There you go. Hercules Gomez. I wasn't the team MVP.
Only developmental player in its history.
There you go. I wasn't the team MVP, but I did play a season in the Premier Arena Soccer League, Herc. How about that?
No way. The Passel? You played in the Passel? I didn't know you played
the
Passel.
The Passel, yes, with the Winchester Impact, rest in peace. They call us the Chivas USA of the PASL.
The Winchester Impact, you said.
The Winchester Impact. Very semi in terms of semi-pro. All right, coming up, we've got an interview with Jonathan Gomez, one we conducted actually a couple weeks ago when he was with the U.S. Men's National Team at January camp. We're going to hear from Jeff Kasouf talking U.S. Women's National Team. She Believes Cup kicks off actually a week from tonight.
Yeah.
Weston McKennie made his first start with Leeds United. Crazy game against Manchester United. We'll recap that. Plus, Herc, some potential changes to Major League Soccer's playoff structure. I wonder what you'll think of those. But let's start this show with some huge news, Herc, out of Mexico. According to reports, Diego Coca is set to replace Tata Martino as Mexico's national team manager. The 50-year-old Argentine was in charge of Tigres. He took over there just as recently as November. But he's best known for taking Atlas to back-to-back titles a couple years ago, ending a 70-year title drought. Coca winning out for this job over candidates like Miguel Herrera, Guillermo Almada, Marcelo Bielsa, Nacho Ambriz, Turco Mohamed, just to name a few. Tigres have confirmed the move with this statement, also relieving Coca of his duties as their head coach. The Mexican Federation, from them, an announcement is expected imminently, certainly by the end of the week. Herc, what do you think? Is Diego Coca the right hire for El Tri?
No. No, certainly not from a stylistic standpoint. Now, I remember this exercise we did with the coaches and the possibles, the safeties, the reach, the dream, all that stuff. You went pragmatic, and you wanted pragmatic. Well, here you go. This is as pragmatic as it gets. Yeah, it was successful with Atlas, but Atlas was a team, and Diego Coca in his DNA is a coach who has no problem with sitting back. He would literally put 10 players behind the ball. It's a defend-first mentality, prioritizes the defensive work rate, and then attacks from there. At Atlas, he was very successful in the way he defended. You could see that first in clean sheets. But in the way they attacked with two, three players tops, and those two players were very special. A Julio Furch, who was physically gifted and just bodied and bopped people around, and a Julián Quiñones that was playing on another level. But what you get out of him is defensive structure, and I would say about that, just that defensive structure. Now, if you had a problem with Tata Martino and his defensive play against Argentina, se murió de nada, se murieron de nada. They didn't die on their show. They didn't do anything. They died playing a way that they've never played. Well, get used to it, because Diego Coca plays that way. Let's absorb. Let's counter. Let's hit him vertically if we can. But if we can't, we're maintaining a zero.
Look, there are a lot of red flags here, Herc. But to your point, the one you raised about his style is, to me, not at all a red flag. That's the one box that he checks for me, is that he is pragmatic. And I think that's what Mexico needs to do at the international level, certainly at the World Cup level, like we saw from Morocco. If they're going to trascender, if they're ever really going to do something special and get past the round of 16 into that quinto partido and beyond, which we know is the goal for the Mexican national team. But for me, when I look at Diego Coca, the red flags are everything else. One is the timing. I don't think I really understand the rush here, right? If you wait till the summer, you're certainly going to have better candidates, more candidates. The second is his resume, Herc. Outside of Atlas, and I'm not suggesting it's any small thing what he did at Atlas, but you got to look really long and really hard to find anything that's a sustained success. In fact, of all of his head coaching jobs, he's only had one, other than Atlas, where he's lasted more than 50 games. To me, I don't see a lot of success here. Even his Liga MX stops other than Atlas. Santos, Cholos, he lost more games than he won. I'm just not convinced of Diego Coca as the manager. And then on top of that, there's no international experience. And if I want to put my fan hat on her, then it's really underwhelming, right? Because this is not an ambitious hire. If I think of the names that the U.S. has been linked to, and maybe it's just links, Zinedine Zidane, Jose Mourinho. If you're a Mexico fan and you would hope for a home run swing, this is certainly not that. This is a very safe choice, it feels.
I don't know about safe choice, because there's nothing safe about the hiring process, and we can get into that in a bit, but you're looking at...
But it's not ambitious. This is not some superstar name. This is not a Bielsa.
This is why it's disappointing, because you had a Bielsa. You had somebody like Guillermo Almada, who's of that cloth, where it's offensive. It plays more to the Mexican player's traits. The Mexican player by DNA isn't a defensive player, isn't a gritty player, isn't a grind it out and look for results type of player. They're a free-flowing, technically sound player in the offensive third. And going back to what you said, you only have a little over 3 years into the World Cup. There are no World Cup qualifiers, so you're just playing friendlies. Time to really implement a style and go forward to change a whole DNA and what could be a transformational process for the Mexican national team. That's going to take more than 3 years. So if you're trying to change the philosophy, that's not something that just changes overnight. The process for me is what gets me. And if I'm a fan, I'm disheartened by what I've seen.
Right. Like, I don't know if he's a bad coach or if he's going to do a bad job here, Herc. But there were better candidates, even of the realistic candidates. And that's regardless of what the criteria is. I don't know what the criteria is here, but if you wanted more Liga MX success, you could point to Guillermo Almada, you could point to Turco Mohamed. You want more international experience, you could point to Piojo. If you want more name, more renombre, more clout, you could have pointed to Bielsa. Like, no matter what the criteria was, Herc, Diego Coca doesn't seem to be the number one guy in any category. So let's get to the
process.
Except
for the championships recently.
Two championships. You're right. Two championships with
what
Atlas.
He did at Racing, what he did at Racing is crazy, by the way. Racing winning after 14 years. I mean, that's a league that's...
Okay, 6 years ago. 6 years ago now.
I'm just saying. But you're right. Like, if you look at the general numbers, there are titles there. A lot of that goes to Grupo Orlegi, by the way. There are titles there. But the overwhelming play... Or I should say the play is overwhelmingly mediocre, despite the titles. That is great. That's what it's about. But just in general.
Herc, as you mentioned, a lot of the criticism to this apparent appointment, we should say, is really coming down, I think, more to the process, right? And when we say process, I think we have to kind of explain it. It feels like more business as usual, kind of like the federation politics were really the driving force behind this decision and not the football, not the soccer. Are you buying that?
I am. There's one opposing group to everything that's been Mexican football over the last, I'd say, two decades, and that is Grupo Pachuca. That is Jesús Martínez. Guillermo Almada plays for one of Jesús Martínez's teams, which is Pachuca. He was a candidate. There's a reason that Jesús Martínez wasn't or isn't in this committee, the ownership committee of five. It's because he knew what was coming. So, in this status quo of everything that is happening, what happens, okay? You have five owners. You have Cholos. Don't ask me why Grupo Caliente is there. You have Chivas, America, Grupo Orlegi, which is Santos, and Atlas, and then Necaxa. In those five, okay, they decided we need to restructure Mexican football. Rodrigo Arres de Parga, who's never been a successful director of anything in Mexican football, leaves Querétaro, which was a dumpster fire, and he's in charge of the hiring process, part of the hiring process where he goes and interviews the candidates. Rodrigo Arres de Parga, Querétaro, which is Grupo Caliente, Cholos in Querétaro, interviews what was supposed to be only Guillermo Almada and Miguel Herrera. Somewhere along the lines, we added the names Ignacio Ambriz, Turco Mohamed, Bielsa, and out of nowhere, Diego Coca, who is already making $4 million a year with Tigres, comes into the process. Why is Diego Coca relevant in this? Who is Diego Coca's representation, his agent. Well, it happens to be Christian Bragarnik, and Bragarnik is a partner with Grupo Caliente. Mm. They own teams together. They own a team in Spain. They have business together in this Grupo Caliente ownership. He owns those teams. He represents Diego Coca, who happens to be with Grupo Caliente, who's part of the committee. And in doing this, putting their candidate out, it eliminates Grupo Pachuca. So this is all a political ploy. And also, by the way, Diego Coca was employed by Orlegi at Santos and at Atlas. So this is all political. So in the process of putting a pawn in there and staking your territory, your land, you also eliminate an opposition, which is Grupo Martinez. This is more of the same, just insert a different name. Back in the 80s, 90s, early 2000s, it's Televisa and their monopoly. Now we're seeing a bit differently.
Yeah. So to boil it down, kind of the national team committee has effectively representation from five ownership groups. And two of those ownership groups, both Xolos and Santos, and of course Atlas and Santos under the same ownership group, have employed Diego Coca at some point. So he had a lot of allies on the committee, and people are pointing that and saying, perhaps rightfully so, that, politics played a role here, Herc. I think what's really disappointing from that perspective is clearly you have a lot of capable people in Mexican soccer in their own little silos. And yet when they come to the table to supposedly reform Mexican soccer, instead of giving us the best candidate, what we get is the candidate of the best politician. And that's not necessarily going to be the best national team coach. You understand what I'm saying? The owner who's the best politician puts his guy in as the national team manager. And that to me is just extremely worrisome. It doesn't feel like everyone's pulling in the same direction. And it doesn't feel like that statement we saw after the World Cup. Remember when we were told, we're going to work together to make this thing work. This still very much feels like factions warring.
It's just sad because you want to see a change for Mexican football. But not only are they not changing, they're reverting to the same deck of cards when it comes to their options. At the sporting level, at the administrative level, at every single level in Mexican football, it's I scratch your back, you scratch mine, let's keep business going.
Real quick, before we move on, do you think he'll be successful?
I think he can be.
He's not a bad coach.
I think he can be successful.
He's not a bad coach.
No, I think he can be successful at a CONCACAF level. Right now, the version we saw of Canada and John Herdman wasn't the same version we saw in World Cup qualifying. Some of those players will be phased out because they are older. Let's see what the new crop comes in. Costa Rica, an enigma. Panama, still very young. We don't know what they're going to be like. And the U.S. men's national team, they don't have a head coach. And if the mantra, the style of play is going to be the same, but maybe the direction isn't there, and maybe these players have outgrown that, what's that going to look like? So Mexico's only, I guess, opposition, if you will, leading into a Gold Cup would be the U.S. men's national team. If they win, Diego Coca's fine. He's going to be there, and he's going to be at whatever other tournament they go to, whether it's Copa America or any other made-up tournament that FIFA or CONCACAF wants to put in their way. And then it's the World Cup. At the World Cup, can he be successful? I don't know. I don't see this group being successful playing that way.
All right. Enough on Diego Coca. Let's talk about a player who he might, Herc, end up managing before not too long. That's Santiago Jimenez, as we run it back. Santiago Jimenez scoring for Feyenoord in the Dutch Cup. Crazy game. Feyenoord advancing in penalties after a 4-4 draw.
Yeah, just hear me out for a second. My man is on fire. All competitions, 9 goals, 1 assist. He's already cost 2 PKs. He's the leading goal scorer in the Europa League. He just keeps getting better. If you were looking for your 9, here's your 9.
And he had to take a penalty in the shootout. And as you can see there, cool, calm, collected. You mentioned 9 goals and 26 appearances since making the move from Cruz Azul for the 21-year-old Mexican who was left off the World Cup squad. The Eredivisie on ESPN Plus this weekend. Great title race with plenty of U.S. and Mexico influence. Feyenoord first, AZ second, Ajax third, PSV fourth, Taylor Booth Utrecht. You see them there. They're in seventh, and Ricardo Pepi's Groningen, their 17th. Don't miss a minute of Match Day 21 action in the Eredivisie on ESPN+.
Hi, this is ESPN's Mike Greenberg, and ESPN Bet is ready to take you through all the biggest sports moments this spring. The official sports book of ESPN has exclusive offers and markets from Scott Van Pelt, Stephen A. Smith, and me. From the upcoming draft, the playoff intensity, and finally getting out to the ballpark, there's no better time for sports fans. Sign up today, and new users get $100 in bonus bets for making any sportsbook bet. Download ESPN Bet today. What a play.
Must be 21 plus and present in select states. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. Terms and conditions apply. See app for details.
Picture this. You arrive at your hotel. You have an important online meeting lined up with clients from all across the country. You have your laptop open, ready to begin, and the Wi-Fi is so terrible, you can't even connect. These types of stressful situations happen all the time, but they don't have to. When you book a room at La Quinta by Wyndham, you have access to their free high-speed Wi-Fi, so you can take care of those critical emails, join your meetings on time, and even unwind by streaming your favorite shows without having to worry. Tonight, La Quinta. Tomorrow, you shine. Book direct at LQ.com.
Kirk, let's talk U.S. managerial job, because we aren't the only ones talking about it. Jim Curtin, currently of the Philadelphia Union, with some interesting comments on the Crack podcast with DeMarcus Beasley and Aguchi Onyewu. Here's what he had to say when asked about the national team gig for 2026.
One man's misery is another man's opportunity. Are you eyeing that U.S. job?
You know what? Of course, I'd love to coach the national team, if that's what you're asking. But I said this before, and I mean what I say when I say it. Whoever they choose, if they choose Jose Mourinho, if they choose Ancelotti, if they choose Jesse Marsh, I'd be their assistant. You know what I mean? Like, that's how important I think this World Cup is.
And
I think
you would leave your head coaching job to be a U.S. assistant.
Yes.
Hercules Gomez. Lots to pick at there. From what we heard from Jim Curtin. Let's start with the idea of a Curtin-Marsh ticket for 2026. Are you backing it, Hercules Gomez?
If it's the lesser of the evils, yes, I am. Let me explain.
Don't sit on the fence.
This is not sitting on the fence. This is not sitting on the fence. Let me explain. Jim Curtin mentioned Jose Mourinho. He mentioned Ancelotti. Mm-hmm. Or any lesser name you want outside of this bubble, this domestic bubble. If that's not attainable, A, because they're not available, or because you can't come to terms, or because, quite frankly, this isn't as desirable as a job as people think, and they may not want to do it in this cycle. If that's not attainable, Jesse Marsh and Jim Curtin are the lesser of the evils. If you're going to go American, American, it's not going to be a Materazzo. It's not going to be a David Wagner. That's just a reality. So what's your pool? This is the lesser of the evils. I understand everybody's worry, and it's probably recency bias when it comes to Jesse Marsh, because a few months ago, everybody would have jumped at the chance of Jesse Marsh. That's a reality. You could say he's failed at certain places he's been at, but he's been there. And for American coaches, you can't take that lightly. So if this is the lesser of the evils, I'm on board for a Jesse Marsh and Jim Curtin ticket, because Jim Curtin, and we see this a lot of times, we just saw Mexico trying to do this. Mexico just tried out for Jimmy Lozano. They tried offering Jimmy Lozano to be the U23 coach and the assistant coach. They did the same thing to Rafa Márquez, who's in Barcelona. If Jim Curtin were to go on in this ticket with whatever national team coach was there, Jesse Marsh or better, I would be on board with that. Him taking the U23 team. Him taking that U20 team and then the U23 team at the Olympics and then being part of this process through 2026. I'm on board for that. It's the lesser of the evils for me.
You could do a lot worse. If you think about the combined resumes between a Marsh and Curtin and compare that to what Greg Berhalter's resume was when he took over this team late 2018, early 2019, you could do a lot worse, right? And Greg Berhalter, for all accounts, you can criticize how it was done, but you have to say, got the team qualified, got him through the group phase, and got him into the knockout round, right? So these two would have much more on their resumes combined than Greg Berhalter had back when he was hired. So I think you could do a lot worse than this ticket, Herc. But what do you make of the idea of Marsh taking a step back, or would it be a step back, to go from head coach of a club team like Philadelphia Union, a successful one, to a national team assistant? Would you do it?
You said Jim Curtin, right?
Mm-hmm.
Sorry, I thought I heard something else for a second. Yes, if I was for him, this makes total sense. Now, it's being involved in a World Cup. Jesse Marsh was one of our assistant coaches in 2010. I was on that team in 2010, South Africa. He was an assistant coach. Being an assistant coach.
Did he leave a head coaching
national
job?
Well, Thierry Henry left a head coaching job to be an assistant coach.
You know? Now, where's he got him? What's the next gig for him?
Anywhere he wants, because if you do well, if you're part of a successful project, you can go on to bigger and better. Now, nobody's keeping an eye on Jim Curtin because of what he's doing to the Philadelphia Union in Europe. But if now you have a coaching resume in a World Cup and it was successful, you'd be damn sure he's going to have somebody somewhere sniffing around. And maybe it's Jesse realizes he doesn't want that. There have been cases, a lot of cases, mm-hmm. where the assistant coach has taken over for the full coach, for the full team coach. A lot of cases, a lot of different national teams, and I'm not saying that's what I want for Jim Curtin, but there are easy ways to get out if you're a coach or somebody in Jim Curtin's position. This is one of them.
Herb, what about having two head coaches, effectively, which is what you would have here, right? Jesse Marsh is the head coach.
There's a hierarchy here, with all due respect to Jim Curtin. Well,
why don't we see more of this, then? Why don't we see more number one guys taking number two jobs? You don't think this could get messy?
With all due respect to Jim Curtin, he's not a number one at that level. So I don't, and he's also best friends with Jesse Marsh. So I don't think it's going to.
So you don't think Jim Curtin's
all.
A candidate for the 2026 job on his own?
No. Mm. I don't think anybody in Major League Soccer right now is a candidate on their own. And if you were, it's because it's a desperate situation and you needed to pull a bombero out of your pocket.
All right, well, kudos to Jim Curtin. Seems selfless, if nothing else, that he would be willing to take the assistant job from a head
Absolutely.
Coaching position. Wait a sec. Oh, just it's a contract year for Jim Curtin.
Oh.
2023, the last year of his contract.
No.
So not bad to be linked to the national team job, whether it's an assistant or head coaching job in a contract
Look at
year.
You. Look at you.
You know all about that. You know all about
no,
that.
No.
You know all about that.
No, I do not. But I'll be here for
all right, we got more coaching news. It's time from the Bundesliga, Herb. Pellegrino Matarazzo didn't stay unemployed for long. The American hired by Hoffenheim just 4 months after getting fired by Stuttgart. He's actually already spent a couple years at Hoffenheim as an assistant and in the youth ranks earlier in his career. Hoffenheim currently 14th in the table, 3 points from the relegation zone, winless in their last 9 league games. Going to get to work with John Brooks and Justin Che, a couple
John Brooks,
of
Justin
Americans.
Che. You know, Pellegrino, have you ever met him? Have you ever talked to Pellegrino, Sebi?
Yes, maybe? Good friend of the program here right. on Football America.
You know, he's part of the Julian Nagelsmann coaching tree then.
From the Bundesliga to the Premier League, Wednesday, Leeds against Manchester United, Weston McKennie's first start. Chris Armas, one of a trio of coaches in charge on an interim basis. 1 minute in. Oh, no. Is this the post-firing bump, Herc?
I mean, it happens to everybody, right? But a minute into the Chris Armas era?
There's Chris Armas talking tactics at halftime. 1-0 Leeds. Couple minutes into the second half. 2-0 Leeds. The own goal here for Rafael Varane.
What type of Ted Lasso is this? 3 minutes into the second half and again.
All right, 53rd minute. Getting chippy. Oh. Weston McKennie going to pick up a yellow card here, Herc.
Do not touch Alberto Carlos, Weston. Weston was up for it, I'll tell you that.
3 minutes later, another American going in the book, this time Tyler Adams.
Yeah, you can always count on him for a hard tackle.
62nd minute, Manchester United cutting into the lead. Marcus Rashford makes it 2-1.
Yeah, Marcus Rashford is scoring goals everywhere, all the time. Can't stop him.
Brendan Aaronson, free kick. Herc, the post!
Yeah, more like the wall. What was that wall doing?
Manchester United looking for an equalizer, and they get it here, Jadon Sancho.
Keeper. May have gotten screened, but right through his hands.
Game ends 2-2. All right, so Herc, for our American contingent at Leeds, was it a good draw, even though they led at 1 point, 2-0?
Well, in the grand scheme of things, yes, because it's Manchester United, because a majority
away.
Of people away,
away,
a majority of people would have chalked this up as 0 points. So mm-hmm. the fact you took something out of it, Manchester United, who have been undefeated in I don't know how many games, one of the hottest teams in the world right now. It's a great result. But all things considered, that you went up not once, but twice on the road with psychological blows in the first minute of each half, 20 minutes to go, and you buckle under pressure that way, it just feels like a terrible result. But if you're looking at this big picture, this is an important game? Sure, every point is important. Every game is important. But it's not as important as what's coming up. Because what's coming up is Everton, who's in 18th place, and Southampton, who's in dead last. Those are 6-point swings. This was get out of here with something. They did that.
Yeah. Look, whoever fired Jesse Marsh was looking for a reaction, right? I mean, clearly they got it here. Not only do you get a goal in the first minute of the first half, you get a goal, what, 3 minutes into the second half? I mean, that tells you something's working in that locker room. I'm not saying producer Beth is in my ear. I'm not saying that there was a heroic Chris Armas speech, but something that's happening in that locker room clearly worked, or at least worked on the day. Here's my question to you, Herc. Does the fact that they seem to have a reaction prove that the Leeds ownership was right, that it was the right time to get rid of Jesse Marsh, or is it proof that had they waited just a few more days, given him just 72 more hours, he could have eked out a result against Manchester United and maybe saved his job?
Neither. It's a testament to teams that fire their coaches, an immediate reaction for the players from the new coach when the new coach comes in, or they know that there's going to be a new coach watching that they're playing for their lives. So there's always an uptick. There's always a reaction. That's all it proves. It doesn't prove that Jesse Marsh was a good coach, a bad coach, that would have done better or worse with or without him. This just proves what we always see. A team fires their coach, there's a reaction.
Good point for Leeds. Good day for U.S. fans. 3 U.S. men's national team players on the field at Old Trafford. Leeds right now 16th, 1 point above the relegation zone. One of those 3 players, Weston McKennie, Herc, made his first start for Leeds since the move to Juve. How'd you rate his performance?
I thought it was good. I thought it was positive. Now, why was it good? Why was it positive? Some of the things we hear when players go and they debut in the Premier League is it took a while to get used to the pace, how fast it is, how frantic it is. Well, Weston McKennie didn't look out of place. In fact, I think he's pretty suited for a lot of the play that's in the Premier League. Defensively, he didn't look out of place or like he wasn't suited defensively. He's shown us things that we knew he had in his bag, that tireless work rate, that willingness to get dirty. You saw him and Luke Shaw getting into it. He didn't look out of place that way. But offensively, this is still a player that's trying to find his way within this system. It's only the second game. It's his first start. I didn't think it was his sharpest going forward. We didn't see that signature Weston McKennie arriving late into the box and becoming a factor type of play or in the final third. But that'll come. That'll come with the cohesion that he'll have with his teammates, getting to know them a little bit better, getting more settled. But defensively, all these other things, he did not look out of place, so I thought it was positive for him.
I made a pros and cons list, Herc.
Of course,
I know you love that. My pros for Weston McKennie, right away, the chemistry with Tyler Adams.
Yeah, evident.
You see it, and you see exactly, one, how useful it's going to be for Leeds, but also I think how they're going to continue to develop that, and that's going to be very good for the national team coming down the road. So that was great. And I think to your point about the skirmish with Luke Shaw, he's got the attitude for the Premier League. I don't know that I thought he was off the pace at all, but I do think his impact was significantly less in the second half compared to the first. And I wonder if that is, yes, he can hang at the pace that the Premier League demands, but only for so long right now. And as these games come thick and heavy, I wonder what you thought about that. Because to me, that was maybe a concern, that what we see at Juve, what we see at Serie A, it is a very different pace. It's not as demanding as one, the Premier League, and two, Leeds.
Take into account the opponent. In that midfield, Fred Savica and Bruno Fernandes. Derek Ray. There's a big difference into that midfield and what he faced in that midfield than what he may have faced already in Serie A week after week, or what he will face in the Premier League mid-table down.
All right. I'm with you, though. Definitely want to see him closer to goal. That was the one thing that I noticed from this game for Leeds. I will also say that when he started at Juventus and even early on at Schalke, I don't remember him being close to goal. It's something that seems to come along later as Weston McKennie settles in with his teams. So we go from the Premier League, Kurt, to the FA Cup, where we find our good friends from Wrexham taking on Sheffield United in the fourth round. Again, this second time these two teams played. First game finished 3-3, so this is the replay. 28th minute chance for Wrexham, their first real chance. Paul Mullen drags it wide. A little bit later on, big opportunity here for Sheffield United. Kurt, explain to me how you don't score this as a striker.
Because you didn't pass the ball. What are you doing, McAtee? What are you doing, Mecca? Pass the ball.
He's keeping Wrexham in it. That's what he's doing, the Sheffield United attacker. Into the second half. Amirozi shoots and scores.
Yeah,
Sheffield United up 1-0.
This is usually game, set, match when you're playing against a lower division mm-hmm. team and you finally put the ball in the back of the net. More will come, especially at home, but the reaction was good.
Yeah, and fifth tier versus second tier. 7 minutes later, we got a penalty for Wrexham. Paul Mullen pulled down in the box. He steps up. Cool as you like down the middle.
Go ahead, Super Paul! Go ahead, Super Paul!
71st minute. More from Wrexham. Yes, another penalty. Are you kidding me?
I'm not. Defending in this game was atrocious on both sides of the ball. And then you blew it!
Oh, Paul Mullen, the second penalty. Always tough to convert. 1-1, deep into stoppage time. Mistake at the back for Wrexham. Billy Sharp. 2-1, Sheffield United.
More like Billy, not so sharp on the defensive end. Tried to pull him that back with his knees. I have no idea what happened. And then, that hurts.
Sander Berge makes it 3-1, Sheffield United. Wrexham's Cinderella run ends, but they become the first non-league team, Herc, in 68 years to total 15 goals, at least 15 goals in their FA Cup run. Historic. Here's a look at the fifth round matchups, which include, for you U.S. men's national team fans, Leeds against Fulham. Should be a tasty one there at Craven Cottage. Let's run it back, Herc. Check in on Tim Weah playing for Lille in the French Cup, where he started left back against Lyon. Had to take a penalty in the shootout off the underside of the crossbar.
Oh no, Timmy. They got him all messed up playing defense now. His head's not in it.
Lille eliminated in the round of 16 after a 2-2 draw in regulation. 22-year-old Tim Weah. Here's a look at his heat map. Recently with Lille, who are out of the cup, but sixth in the French top flight.
10 seconds on the clock. How many things can you name that are always growing? Your relationships, your skills, your customer base. How about businesses on Shopify? Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage, to the first real-life store stage, all the way to the did we just hit a million orders stage, Shopify's there to help you grow. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/network, all lowercase. Go to shopify.com/network now to grow your business, no matter what stage you're in. shopify.com/network.
Tired of ads interrupting your favorite sports podcasts? Good news! Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music, included with your Prime membership. Amazon Music offers the most ad-free top podcasts. Enjoy shows like First Take, Pardon the Interruption, and The Low Post, available ad-free and uninterrupted. To start listening, download the Amazon Music app or go to amazon.com/ESPNpods. That's amazon.com/ESPNpods to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Robin will get onto the end of it. Hatch is there in the middle. It's Hatch with a chance. It's Hatch with a goal. And that's a decent cross all the way to off the bar. And Rose LeBard gets the goal. Lavelle with two goals gets this one in towards the back post. And it's five goals as Taylor Korniak scores. Hey.
Chiba Leagues Cup kicks off 1 week from today, next Thursday in Orlando, USA against Canada. There's the 23-player roster, Latko Andonovski picked for the tournament. Alex Morgan, Megan Rapinoe in. No Sophia Smith, still recovering from that foot injury. Tomorrow on the U.S. Women's National Team, we call on our friend and colleague, Jeff Kasouf. You can check out his latest work actually over at ESPN.com. Dropped his latest article yesterday. Jeff, welcome back to the show. Great to have you.
Yeah, thanks for having me again. Appreciate it.
All right, so as you just saw there, we were looking at the Chiba Leagues Cup roster for the U.S. Women's National Team. How close do you think this roster is the one we'll actually see at the World Cup this summer?
I think it's very close. I mean, the bubble has thinned out. Vlatko Andonovski said last month in New Zealand that his list of 23 that he'll take to the World Cup is down to 32. You can pretty much name them off at that point when you've got 24 in camp. You've got still a few injured that are major injuries that you'd expect to be in the mix. So I think really this is a group that's close, maybe not exact, but we're at that point where after Chiba Leagues Cup, we only have one window until he's going to name a World Cup roster. So I think we're pretty close at this point.
You say the bubble has thinned. Tell us who's on it. So who needs like a really good Chiba Leagues Cup to lock down their World Cup spot?
Yeah, I think there's a couple sides of the bubble, right? I think there are people who are just on the bubble, maybe by way of some of those injuries, and you could argue maybe, is a Trinity Rodman on the bubble? I think she's done enough to prove that she should and will be at the World Cup. You know, there are other wingers. Lynn Williams has just come back from injury. I think we've seen historically in this Vlatko Andonovski era that Lynn Williams is a go-to forward for him on both sides of the ball. So I think her being healthy again, I think she's firmly in that picture. So, you know, I think you could argue that a Rodman maybe by way of that is on the bubble, but for me, she's in that picture. You look at the midfield, and Sam Coffey is a player who is not in this camp. She didn't play a single minute in New Zealand. We thought maybe she was a potential answer as a backup number six, and now Taylor Korniak is getting time there, got a few minutes in New Zealand. I don't know that it went super well, but it was the first time with that experiment, and you know, we've come to learn that she's training there again in this camp. So I think, you know, she's a player too where it seems like Vlatko Andonovski wants to get her involved. She's the tallest field player on record in U.S. program history. I think there's obvious benefits there as you get late into a match, whether she's higher up the field in the number six. So, you know, I think she's a player who, Vlatko's clearly trying to find a place for. And then some midfielders who have been on the fringe there. Kristy Lewis has gotten a few minutes. I think that those are probably the players that are sort of on that depth chart, those depth positions in midfield especially.
Jeff, it's been a while since we've had this many doubts or questions about a U.S. women's national team. What's the biggest question for Vlatko heading into the Chiba Leagues Cup?
Yeah, I think the midfield is just that sort of evergreen question, right? I think, you know, at this point, we know who his preferred midfield is. And maybe for some time at the end of last year, we sort of from the outside wondered, okay, we've seen what he clearly prefers, but is he going to stick with it? Does it work? Especially after that rough October-November window where, you know, the losses to England, Spain, Germany. And we come back in New Zealand and we see that some combination of Rose Lavelle, Lindsay Horan, Andy Sullivan is the preferred midfield trio. So, you know, I think that the question marks, you're right. There's more questions on this roster overall. And I think for me, it's probably, they probably all boil down to experience, right? Because we look at this U.S. team and the past two cycles, we've been used to saying, okay, big names. And so many of them that aren't in this picture haven't been for some time. And we know, okay, you can probably rely on them in a big moment. You know what they can do at a World Cup or against a top opponent. Most of these players still, we only have that sample size against the top opponents of England, Spain, Germany in the fall, and that didn't go so well. So now we've got Canada, Brazil, Japan. I think this is going to be a really big test for this group that, yes, they've now gone through a year together mostly as this same core. Yes, they've gone through qualifying, but that first big prime test for them in the fall didn't go so well. So this is, again, top 10 opponents, three of them in a week. I think they've really got to show up collectively here to show that they can do that at a World Cup.
Okay, so you've talked about this field and the Chiba Leagues Cup. I'm not going to ask Sebi because Sebi's always going to go with the U.S. Women's National Team. He thinks they're invincible. So, Jeff, can they win this tournament? Should they win this tournament?
I think they can win this tournament. I think they'll want to. I think they need to, at a minimum, show up You know, of course, results are important, but I think when you look at the England game, the midfield really got played out, right? I mean, England dominated the middle of the park. Spain, I think, was a major disappointment, and then the Germany game that followed. The actual production, the actual way that the U.S. played in those games, I think, was some level of average to poor, given, you know, whatever game or whatever moment of the game. So I think at minimum, they need to be in these games against these three opponents and show that they can hang. If that's Brazil 1v1 defending against really technical players, if that's matching Canada, again, a very similar physical style. And obviously they did that at qualifying in the final. And then Japan, another really technical team that can challenge them defensively in ways that, you know, New Zealand didn't, obviously, in ways that Spain, Germany, England challenged them. So I think that, you know, the results need to be there, but, you know, at minimum, we need to see that this team can hang with top teams in the world, which I don't think that they necessarily showed us in October and November.
Jeff, got a couple quotes here that made headlines. The first is from Vlatko Andonovski in one of his recent press conferences. He mentioned two names that were very interesting to me, and I know very interesting to a lot of U.S. women's national team fans, Kristen Press and Tobin Heath. Is there any chance we see either or both of those players on the roster this summer?
Look, Kristen Press is the really intriguing one here, right? I think she was in top form at the beginning of the NWSL season last year. She got hurt. We came to find out she wasn't being called into qualifying anyway. But, you know, she's a player who you know you can rely on in those big moments, as I mentioned before. You know, in top form is exceptional individually and can bring something to a game. And I think when you look at this U.S. roster, this forward line, certainly on the wings, is set, right? It's Sophia Smith, it's Mallory Swanson, barring injuries. So anybody else needs to be a game changer off the bench. And in some ways, you've got sort of these specialty players. If you're chasing a game, you've got Megan Rapinoe to bring in those final moments on set pieces to do something, a moment of magic. If you're protecting the lead, you've got Lynn Williams, as I mentioned. And I think Kristen Press certainly can offer, similar to Rapinoe, a different role than we're used to her traditionally over the past decade with the U.S., but I think she could offer something unique for this U.S. team. The question for her, obviously, especially, is that race against time. There's only one window in April. NWSL season doesn't start till March 25th. So then you're talking about, even if she's in great form, even if you know what she can bring, you're probably looking at bringing her into a World Cup camp for the first time in almost 2 years, having not been in that environment. And then, you know, there's sort of those intangible questions maybe that you have to face if you're Vlatko Andonovski.
Jeff, what about the comments from Alex Morgan? She used the word bizarre to describe a potential Saudi sponsorship of the upcoming Women's World Cup. She also talked about the decisions made where the U.S. Women's National Team plays its games here in the United States. What'd you make of it, grabbing quite a bit of headlines?
Yeah, I mean, I think everybody was taken aback by the Saudi Arabia news of a World Cup sponsor, the Women's World Cup. I think, you know, I'm interested to see how this plays out because we've seen that players on the women's side especially, I think, have had a certain amount of leverage of power to enact and enforce change, certainly domestically here and I think increasingly globally. So, you know, I mean, we saw, right, we just had a Men's World Cup in Qatar. There was so much pushback against that, but ultimately maybe a feeling of resignation by some that, like, this is how it is, this is how it goes, and this is where that World Cup is going to be, and ultimately was. This obviously a little bit different in that it's a sponsorship versus, you know, the logistics of a host country, you know, but there's obviously a lot of money involved in those things as well. So I'm really curious to see if the players have enough leverage here to push back in a way that might nullify a deal like this. I might be surprised if that happens, just because I think if this deal is done in the way that it's been reported, it's probably big money, and it's a big money investment in a FIFA World Cup, and I think FIFA's probably happy with that.
All right, Jeff, before we let you go, we got to talk about the NWSL schedule, which, of course, finally, at long last, dropped. Everybody was waiting, and I mean everybody was waiting. They found it on the side of a milk carton. The NWSL schedule drops. Let's start with the obvious question. It's a World Cup year, so how are they going to deal with that?
Yeah, I think this has been a real point of contention. I reported on recently that the FIFA windows, the NWSL has not traditionally followed these international windows. And now they're attempting to, and that's creating some friction. They have a calendar that doesn't always align with it. So there was friction around this February window of releasing players a week ahead of the FIFA window. And they'll release them 2 weeks ahead of the FIFA window for the World Cup, actually. July 10th, that opens. NWSL players of all nationalities will be released on June 26th. So again, as we've seen in 2015 and 19, significant disruption to the NWSL season. I think this is a problem that's not going away. I will give them some credit for mitigating this to the degree that they can in the short term, which is, you know, two weekends off instead of one. I don't think that really solves a problem, but combined with the fact that they have really scheduled the Challenge Cup for predominantly to be in that World Cup window, where, you know, I think a lot of people objectively look at the Challenge Cup as a secondary competition. So scheduling that exclusively into the World Cup, I think that's sort of doing the best you can with the situation you're presented if you're the NWSL, which is you don't have a significant disruption to the regular season where you get to the end of the season and say, okay, these players were gone, and obviously it affected the standings. I think they did the best that they could with a bad situation. And now, as I've kind of been reporting over these past few weeks, they've really got to figure out what is next year, what do the next 5 years look like to figure this problem out, because FIFA windows aren't going away. FIFA wants to add a Club World Cup. There's still talk of a biennial World Cup. I mean, there are things that are only going to create further problems for a league that plays through the summer in a world that's based around a European calendar that doesn't.
Congrats, Jeff. You just depressed me. All right, give me something positive. Give me a few positives of the NWSL season schedule.
Well, look, I mean, I do think the positive is that they manage the situation the best that they can in terms of the Challenge Cup. And the big thing for me, and I think we talked about it on this show a few months ago, right, is we have a decision day now. MLS has incorporated that over the years. We've always sort of had that in the European leagues that don't have playoffs, obviously, of simultaneous kicks to end the season. So I give them credit to finally have that. I wish we had it last year. We could have had really the most ridiculous final day that we've ever seen if we had it last year. I don't know if we'll get that again this year, but the fact that we have October 15th, 5 p.m. kicks every team, I'm interested to see, do we get another shield battle that changes by the minute? Do we get a team dropping in and out of the playoffs by the minute? I think that's probably the overriding big win from this schedule.
Decision day drama sounds like just what the NWSL needs. Jeff Kasouf, thanks for joining us here on Football America. It's always great to have you.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
Here's a look at some key dates for the NWSL's 2023 schedule, which starts on March 25th. Another shout for Jeff's article over on ESPN.com. The U.S. Women's National Team Big Four, the list of 23 ahead of the Summer World Cup. Time to turn back to the men's game now and our previously recorded interview with Jonathan Gomez from U.S. Men's National Team January Camp. You're very young, Jonathan, but you've already moved around quite a bit in your career. You go to Louisville, then you go to Real Sociedad. You've been in the U.S. national team camp before. You've been in the Mexico national team camp before. All of that is to say you've walked into a lot of locker rooms for the first time. When you walked into this locker room for the first time with Anthony Hudson and this staff, what was the message that stood out to you? What did they want to drive home?
The message from Anthony Hudson and his staff, well, part of his staff is actually Mikey Varas, the under-20 coach, who I've obviously been working with, but it was to kind of what I said, to take advantage of the opportunity and have fun. I mean, that's obviously we're all here because football is our passion and we all want to have fun with it, but yeah, it was to take advantage of the opportunity, don't put pressure on yourself and just enjoy the moment.
Speaking of opportunities, you're one of the players, many now, that have the opportunity to play for both the United States and Mexico. Let's start with something that comes up a lot on this show when Hercules Gomez talks about it. He says that for all of you guys that are of the age that are Olympic eligible, the fact that the U.S. has Olympics and an under-20 World Cup in your case is a very important part of the decision-making process. Do you feel that that's true?
Yeah, I think there's some truth to that. It's definitely a factor. Like you said, I'm U20 eligible and Olympic eligible. So when you're making it a decision as a player, you obviously factor both of those things in, because those are developmental tournaments. I mean, obviously a huge opportunity to play in any World Cup, a U20 World Cup, and then obviously Olympics is as well an opportunity of a lifetime. So there's definitely truth to that.
You know, and I know you know about this because you grew up in Texas. So you know about high school football and getting recruited to colleges and the big colleges. I kind of imagine you a little bit as a recruit. You've been into the Mexican national team camp. You're now at the U.S. camp. What's it like being in the camp in this phase where, I don't know, maybe the guys there are kind of trying to convince you to join the program?
Well, I guess there's also plenty of, I don't know about plenty, but there's also a few other players in my situation, obviously Brandon Vasquez, Sendejas, who when I went to the Mexican camp, Sendejas was also there. So I spoke to him a little bit about it. But I wouldn't really say they're necessarily trying to convince me. I think everyone's just trying to, I guess, create a good atmosphere. And at the end of the day, like you said, it's my decision, so it'll come down to, I guess, whatever I decide. But they're just trying to make the most enjoyable atmosphere for me, for all the guys. For us to want to come back, and not just me, all the guys. I mean, for the guys that it's their first camp, make a good impression and make everyone want this to be where they want to be.
You're one of the few guys that's been in both camps at the senior level. What's the difference? Or what are some of the differences?
Well, the language. I wouldn't say there's too many differences, to be honest. I think, I guess this camp has been shorter, and there's been two games, so the focus has been more on the games. I would say when I went with the Mexican national team, there was a big emphasis on the game that we played against Guatemala. And then here, I think they do a good job of emphasizing on the training as well. I mean, I know Anthony's obviously came in as the interim coach, and we've had a short time, like I said. Guys came in at different times. We had two games, not that many training sessions, but they've still been able to emphasize the ideas in the training sessions, how we want to press, how we're going to build out, stuff like that.
I know this is a big decision for you. I know it's kind of looming over the rest of your career. Do you have a timetable? Do you know kind of when you want to make up your mind by and kind of have this in the rearview mirror?
I wouldn't say there's a timetable. I don't think I pressure myself to that decision at all. I think it's just, I mean, as of right now, enjoy the moment that I'm here with the U.S. national team, take advantage of this camp, and then after, go back to my club. And ultimately, if I don't do my job at my club, there's not going to be national team opportunities. So I need to do my job there, and then from there, we'll see. So I wouldn't say there's a specific timetable or any, I guess, clock that's ticking in my head, like, oh, by in a year I need to make this decision, et cetera.
Let's talk about your club. How are things going at Real Sociedad? You've been there now quite a while.
Yeah, I've been there. I got there in January of 2022, so I've been there just over a year, 13 months. And I would say it's going well. I'm really happy at the club. Obviously on the field as well as off the field. Off the field, I feel like my adaptation process has gone well. I was able to get a car. I have a good living situation. So all that stuff I'm happy with, and I think I'm progressing well as a player. The club has a really good setup, and yeah, I'm happy to be there and hopefully continue to develop.
What was that jump like to make the move from Louisville and USL to training with a La Liga team?
I think mentally, I think I prepared myself mentally for it because I knew it was going to be a jump in, obviously, the level, and there was obviously going to be outside factors, like time change, just stuff like that. But I think more stuff off the field my brother prepared me for, who's obviously been in Europe longer than I have, and then I could focus more on the field stuff. And I think as I've been training more and more there, obviously playing as well, I've gotten better and better. At first, when I started out, it was kind of like a shock, I would say, in the level. And not that I was out of place or anything like that, but I just think that I was like impressed. And then as time went on, I got better and better. And now I'm just, obviously continuing to get better.
How close do you feel to the first team?
I wouldn't say I'm super close, or I wouldn't say I'm super far. I think it's all relative. I think for me, I just have to be patient. They obviously have a plan for me, and I just have to stick to that plan and continue to perform well, train well when I get that opportunity to train with them. When I get opportunities to play in a friendly with the first team, then show well there and take advantage of those opportunities. And I'm sure my time will come.
Jonathan Gomez, taking advantage of those opportunities. Thanks for joining us here on Football America. It's great to have you.
Thank you for having me on.
Always good to have Jonathan Gomez here with us on Football Americas, from national team camp back in January. Let's take a look at some of his stats, certainly from the game against Serbia. Overall, Herc, how'd you rate his performance back in January with the U.S.?
You know, he's a player that I want to jump out of the screen for me because of just the story. He's a great story, you know. Mexican-American kid, comes out of USL, goes to Europe. He's in a legit setup. You want to see him succeed, and you've seen him now at two separate national teams, Mexican national team and the U.S. men's national team, albeit brief appearances. His first with the U.S. men's national team causes the goal that gives him the victory over Bosnia in that January camp, last January camp. And then you watch him here, and he plays a lot, plays the whole game. And you're thinking, when is he going to jump out of the screen? He's taking guys on, but he's coming back. He's looking to get crosses. Some of them aren't too effective. Yes, you get him off, but not so precise. I understand he's 19 years of age, but as a outside back, that to me is important. You want to show me how good your team is with the ball, what type of team you have? Show me your outside backs. That's how I will know. He lost the ball 25 times in this game. A lot of that is because he's taking chances, and I understand that. You get into the final third, take chances, and make your name. But he didn't do anything where he jumped out of the screen for me. And for me, to make a decision off of him, and that may be harsh, that may be unfair, but that's what it's going to take. It's going to take him jumping out of the screen to continue to get these call-ups, to continue to get invited back, to continue to have two nations fight for him. And I just felt, and maybe not his fault, but if you're asking me what did I see from him in this game, nothing that jumped out of the screen.
Yeah, nothing that makes you call him back in, right? And that's the real question. Did he do enough to earn another call-up? And you're thinking about March and the CONCACAF Nations League and what the options will be for Anthony Hudson, we assume, with U.S. soccer. You're going to take Anthony Robinson, right? Assuming Anthony Robinson's healthy, he's there. Dest, Scally, Vines, your boy Tolkien, who, by the way, played pretty well, I thought, against Colombia.
Vines, you said?
Yeah, there are a lot of options at left back. I'm not saying they're all ahead of Jonathan Gomez, but a lot of those guys are ahead of Jonathan Gomez. And how many left backs are you calling in the March window?
Yeah, he's young as well, and there comes a maturation period with being so young and learning. And when you're, I don't care what you guys think of outside backs. If you're an outside back, you saw how many times he was on the ball. You're close to the 90 times on the ball. In a way, you dictate play. You need to be more influential. Influential in how you go forward, influential in how you take care of the ball, and influential in the way you prioritize the team's attack. So there's still room for growth there. But just based off this appearance, I don't think we're making any rash judgments just yet.
You're definitely active, maybe not impactful enough, as you say, just yet. We got more dual national news, Hercules Gomez, and more defender news, actually. The latest on Julian Araujo and that failed transfer from the LA Galaxy to Barcelona. Matteo Alemany, the Barcelona sporting director, said that the club has appealed Araujo's case to the Court of Arbitration for Sport, and that even if Barcelona doesn't succeed in court, Alemany claims that Araujo will, quote, play somewhere else for 5 months and then join Barca B in the summer. So, yay. All's well that ends well, Herc. What do you think about that?
That's somewhere else for 5 months. Is he talking about the LA Galaxy? Because they're in Coachella right now, and there is no Julian Araujo appearance to be seen.
Yeah, I don't think he cares who it is for the next 5 months. Of course, La Liga is available to you right here on ESPN+. And on Sunday, you can catch Luca de la Torres, Celta de Vigo, against Atletico Madrid.
The 2024 NFL Draft heads to Detroit, and it's time to see who gets the job.
Caleb is a unique and special talent throwing the football.
And what sets them apart.
The Heisman Trophy winner is Jaden Daniels.
All of the greats were hired here.
What a throw by Mahomes.
See who gets the job.
Are you ready?
The 2024 NFL Draft begins Thursday, April 25th on ESPN, ABC, and NFL Network.
Time to check the mentions, Herc. Been a while since we did this, going back to our days, or should I say, nights in Doha, taking questions from our friends, fans, and followers on social media. The first one here from Joe Otaka, I remember him, or her, from the World Cup in Qatar. What's the likelihood of Diego Coca making it all the way to the World Cup as Mexico coach? Herc, he hasn't even officially been hired yet. We're already talking about when he's going to be fired.
Yeah, well, he's been outed, if you will. Tigres, in their disgust over the decision, pretty much said he's going to the Mexican national team. That's more than official. It would take something crazy for that not to go that way. You know what? So I was thinking about this. Let's do the math. Tata Martino, the whole cycle. Juan Carlos Osorio, the whole cycle. Okay? There was no cycle with Miguel Herrera. He was the second coach brought in that cycle. And before that, a third coach.
There were four coaches used
well,
in that
there was
cycle.
An interim, you, yeah, you there was an interim interrupts. Tag, yeah. So I think they're due. And the reason I say this is the only thing that could impede a CONCACAF coach from making it and a team like the U.S. men's national team or a team like the Mexican national team or even the Costa Rican national team would be an abysmal showing in maybe three of the tournaments from now today when we do this show to the World Cup. I'm talking Nations League. I'm talking Gold Cup, which could be expanded, and there could be some very good level there, and Copa America. If you have an abysmal showing and things don't go your way, I don't think Mexico thinks twice about this.
So one of my complaints about this hire is that it's not very ambitious. But hires that are not ambitious are also not that expensive, which I think lets you get out, right? It gives you an exit ramp. One of the things always talked about, Herc, with Tata Martino was the amount of money he was on and that the Mexican Federation did not want to have to eat that financial bullet. So I think here there is potential for an out because I don't think he's going to cost all that much money, certainly not compared to some big name like global elite manager. And then beyond that, I think the 2024 Copa America is a pretty serious referendum, dude. You go out there, you have a Juan Carlos Osorio, 7 goals, and even though JCO survived it, I don't know that Diego Coca would. All right, let's get to our next question here.
$4 million net he made from Tigres. Well, would have made.
That is a lot of money, and they're going to have to pay him more than that. So you're right. They're going to be eating some change if they get rid of him. Rodrigo asks, are you cool with the new proposed MLS playoff structure? The details here reported by The Athletic. There's going to be 18 teams in the playoffs, Herc, with best of three in the first round. What do you think? You cool with it?
No. I also, do I think it'll happen? Also, yeah. Probably no. I think they use, and I've seen this floater around a bit. We've seen this. They gauge the people. Okay, we've seen this.
Sure.
All right. But why would they want to do this? Okay. Why would they want to go best of three and like 60-something percent of the league getting in? Because they want money. They want more games, which equal more money, which is the gate, the sponsorships, the TV.
Playoff
everything.
Home games.
Playoff home games.
Playoff home games. That's where you make your money.
Why on earth would the players agree to this? Why on earth does anybody think this is a good idea? They finally found a format that made an irrelevant regular season relevant, somewhat relevant. It's one game, do or die, best seed hosts it, and you're gone. It was the best playoff scenario they've ever had in their history, and they're moving away from it. Why?
Yeah.
Money.
Yeah. My favorite playoffs were 2019. I just love the one and done. I hate the idea of going back to three. And Herc, the idea of 18 out of 29 teams, that's another thing we're going to have to talk about here with these proposals. 62% of the league. Now you're getting into Liga MX territory, and we know the impact that that's had. Yeah, former Liga MX territory, producer Beth reminds me. But we know the impact that that's had on players in the national
Breeds
team. Let's get to the third
mediocrity.
Question. Third question here on Check the Mentions. What do we got from our our loving and adoring public, from Nathan's interior decorator. All right. How do you guys feel about LAFC's John Thorington for sporting director or general manager for U.S. soccer? Do you think he'd leave LA for the national team, and could he even do both jobs? A lot of questions there, Hurt. Pick one, or pick them all.
So there are a few candidates, if you were to go in this side of the world, who has done well at an administrative role that used to play, that has those connections and can be that bridge. Yeah, John Thorington's a realistic name because of the success he's had on all levels. Garth Lagerwaite is also a very interesting name, who's done it over a much longer extended period of time.
So, and in multiple spots.
And in multiple spots.
Thorington has only done it with LAFC.
Real Salt Lake, the Seattle Sounders, and now we're going to see what this new wave with Atlanta United can create. But I would go the tried and proven if you were going to go that way. Now, you could also go a different way and go somebody foreign, somebody that you may have heard of or may not have heard of. But what's the stop of Dennis DeClose, from being a productive, you know, director or GM?
I like Thorington for the future. Maybe not quite yet. He's been only at LAFC.
He's earned having his name there, though, Seb. That's a fact.
100%. Because he's been there at LAFC since the very, very beginning. He built it, so he gets a lot of the credit for what they've done. And they built a great team at first. They had to rebuild it again. So I think he's a name for the future, but maybe not quite yet. Maybe there's other Americans ahead of him, but we talked about this. I think it must have been a digital segment. I love Dennis DeClose. I don't think there's a box that he doesn't check for the sporting director
position. That's right. You did say that. Yeah.
All right. Last question here on Check the Mentions. This is the last one, yeah? Last one. La última y nos vamos. Last question for me today, says Antonio. Must have sent in a few. For the 2025 Gold Cup, who would y'all like to compete from Africa, South America, Europe, and Asia, ideally? And can a CONCACAF team win it all? All right, so the 2025 Gold Cup, Herc, which you mentioned, reportedly going to be expanded to 24 teams. There would be 16 from CONCACAF, and then two each from Europe, Africa, Asia, and South America. What do you think?
Yes. You're asking the guest nations. Okay, Argentina, Morocco, South Korea. Who am I missing? Oh, yeah. And you would, and then, oh, for this, France or Portugal?
Ooh, Portugal. Okay. Are you thinking like, you think a little CR7, like farewell tour or something? This is 2025. It's a ways away.
You see what I did there?
Yes. My votes would be England, France for European teams. Africa was tough. I wanted to say Senegal, Egypt, because you get stars. You get Salah and Sadio Mane.
Oh, you're doing two from each?
You get two from each. Yeah, you get two from each.
Then, yeah, okay. Then if I'm going to another African nation, I would have gone.
Nigeria has huge expat population here. That would be, you get some great crowds.
Yeah, but I'm not thinking about who's here in the States. I'm thinking about who deserves it. I don't go like you, Seb.
Puro marketing, Seb, huh?
Yeah. Can I go Ghana, though? Just because I think that's a good little crossover with the U.S.
Sure. Just make sure Argentina, Brazil are there. Asia, I said Japan. I wouldn't mind seeing Australia after what they did in the World Cup. One thing I would say, Herc, there's potential in that tournament for CONCACAF to get embarrassed. If we really invite all the teams that we're talking about, I could see a U.S., Mexico, Canada, and or all three, you know, going out before the semifinals. And that would be a bad look. In your own continental tournament, none of your teams make the Final Four?
Well, what do you want? Don't invite anybody then.
No, it's good, right? You want the competition. Just might not look good on paper. All right, a reminder, Bundesliga weekend schedule here on ESPN+. Plus. We got Kevin Paredes' Wolfsburg kicking things off on Friday. We got Gio Reyna in Dortmund on Saturday, Jordan Pifak in Union Berlin on Saturday, and Pellegrino Matarazzo's first game in charge of Hoffenheim. That game on Saturday as well against Bayer Leverkusen. All that available for you on ESPN+. Plus. All right, that'll do it for this edition of Football Americas. A reminder, on Monday's show, a two-on-one interview with Gerard Shaqiri of the Chicago Fire from MLS Media Day. We had a great time with Gerard. Yeah. Great time.
Well, I had a great time. He didn't really like you with him. He did not like you when he saw you. He's like, it's you. It's you.
All right, we'll save that for Monday. Don't miss it. Gerard Shaqiri, 2-on-1 here on Football Americas. He's Hercules Gomez. I'm Sebi Salazar. Thanks for watching. Have a good weekend.